The family I grew up in was a classic, tightly knit, boundaried nuclear family. The people I saw most of were my parents, my brother and sister, and my mother's grandparents. When my grandmother died, my grandfather came to live with us, and we became a three-generation family under one roof. But contact with or close involvement with cousins, aunts and uncles and so forth was very limited. The tight six of us was the definition of family that counted. When I went out into the big wide world, I discovered to my great surprise that other families did things very differently. Catholic and immigrant families of my acquaintance had a much wider sense of family. I was astonished to hear that they thought nothing of sitting down to Christmas dinner with 20 or so wider family members. A lot of time and energy went into marking significant life events of all the members of these generously defined families, and they often took delighted interest in the private lives of one another. Theirs was a rich and interconnected world of kith and kin, often not without tension and conflict, but almost always full of warm interest and care for one another. This kind of discovery about these wider families has come to be, anyway, for me, a way into understanding something of the recent history and possibilities of the wider Anglican family around the world that we know as the Anglican Communion. It began, really, almost accidentally. In 1800, the Anglican Church really only consisted, or really only existed, in the Church of England in Britain, and in North America, Canada, and a few isolated pockets of the British Empire. By 1900, branches of it were established pretty much all over the globe, thanks to the evangelizing fervor of Anglican missionary societies and the spread of the British Empire. While there were a few linkage points to bind all these branches together, that didn't matter too much, because the far-flung provinces tended to be Anglophile in spirit and were often staffed in their upper echelons by Englishmen anyway. From the 1950s on, a different spirit was abroad in the Anglican world. Newly autonomous provinces were determined to be authentically themselves, and as teenagers often do, they set about making it clear that they were as different as they could be from their parent body. In this era, the different Anglican provinces wrote their own prayer books, made all their senior appointments from locals, and in cases like New Zealand, with its three tikanga constitution, sometimes made quite radical adjustments in their internal arrangements. They were free to do this because of the Anglican notion of dispersed authority, in which each province had the right to order its life, and each bishop and diocese had a considerable degree of independence in making its own decisions. Anglicans rejoiced in the liberty and tolerance that the system allowed them, while at the same time thinking of themselves as a more united and disciplined church than many other varieties of Protestantism, because of, for instance, their worldwide respect for the office of the Archbishop of Canterbury. This way of worldwide belonging more or less worked so long as it was not put to the test by any hot-button issues. The ordination of women was just such an issue, and it almost sundered the Anglican Communion. What saved the day was that institutions had slowly and belatedly developed that enabled the passionately deadlocked Anglican provinces to consult with one another, to negotiate with one another, and to work out ways to live with their differences. The Lambeth Conference of Bishops developed in the late 19th century as a once in 10 years meeting of the Anglican bishops presided over by the Archbishop of Canterbury. It came into existence to deal with a crisis. A missionary bishop in South Africa was thought to be undermining the authority of the Bible. The Archbishop of Canterbury took it upon himself to call together his brother bishops from across the world to confer together about a joint approach to the problem. So it came to pass that the most well-known of what we now call instruments of communion came into existence. Others would follow. In 1968, the Anglican Consultative Council emerged, a smaller body, meeting more often, and with lay people and clergy represented on it. Our Bishop John Patterson of Auckland and Dr. Tony Fitchett of Dunedin were key players in it. Then in 1978, regular worldwide meetings of the primates, the chief bishops of each province, began. It needs to be emphasized that none of these bodies have the power to make binding decisions on the common life of the different parts of the Anglican family. They are forums that can provide inspiration, avenues of negotiation, and mutually agreed ways forward based on goodwill. The willingness to consult with one another is the crucial ingredients, and that is what saved the day over the ordination of women. The American Episcopal Church, the bold innovator in this finely calculated gamble, did consult with the above-mentioned bodies before it took each decisive step. We might note that the Episcopal Church has always seen itself as the progressive engine of change in the worldwide Anglican family, a role to some extent thrust upon it when it had to make its own arrangements for Episcopal governance after the American War of Independence, and also because of the considerable clout given it by its great financial generosity. The Americans take pride in their self-appointed role as avant-garde pioneers and agents of change in the life of the Communion. It was events in the American Episcopal Church that sparked off the long-running controversy over human sexuality that continues to trouble the Anglican Communion. The decision by the Diocese of New Hampshire to consecrate as its next bishop a priest who was living in a same-sex relationship, and the willingness of the American Episcopate to carry out this consecration, provoked a crisis that reverberated throughout the Anglican world. What went wrong over the Gene Robinson affair was that this time the Episcopal Church did not consult before it acted. It gambled on once again dragging the rest of the Anglican Communion in its wake, however reluctantly, an assumption that proved to be disastrously wrong. Bishops and clergy in committed same-sex relationships proved to be an even more hot-button issue than the ordination of women. The Episcopal Church was plunged into a state of external and internal schism. Not just parishes, but entire dioceses broke away from it to form the Anglican Church in North America. Significant provinces in Africa, the Middle East and Asia broke off relations with the Episcopal Church. But even more crucially, this debacle brought out into the open the Anglican Communion's authority problem, an issue that had been coming up on the lift for a long time. Incidentally, as an afterthought to the incident that sparked all the trouble, Gene Robinson, recently retired as Bishop of New Hampshire, has now divorced his partner whom he married. What happened next was that the instruments of communion failed, one after the other, to deal with the problem. They could pass resolutions. They could call on different provinces of the communion to do certain things. But nothing happened in response. These resolutions and appeals had no binding force, and there was no central administrative unit to follow up on important matters and to progress them. There was an attempt to generate a fresh solution to the problem. The Windsor Report tried to find a way out of the mess we're in by emphasising the instruments of unity I've mentioned before. It proposed to strengthen the role of the Archbishop of Canterbury to a limited extent. It also proposed to create a new instrument of unity, a covenant, which each province of the Anglican Communion would be invited to sign up to. If it had come to pass, it would have created, in effect, a gold standard of Anglican belonging of those provinces prepared to sign up to all the articles of required belief and ethics, and a silver standard for those second-tier provinces that would have been Anglican in ethos only. But the covenant is now dead in the water because not enough provinces were prepared to agree to it. There was a fear of what sounded like an international code of canon law with binding influence, and an anxiety about the possibility of external intervention if a province had done something daringly different. The problem was and is that Anglicans are not prepared to accept the gift of authority as something that comes from God for the wise ordering of his church. We are not prepared to defer to one another in love, accepting that the rich and deep fellowship of Christ's body on earth matters more than our pet projects and enthusiasms. Anglicans pay lip service to the ideal that we should be an interdependent family of mutually supporting and correcting provinces. However, the reality is that they value their autonomy and independence more than their desire to belong to one another in a family whose unity has some depth and texture. The truth is that we cannot remain together as a worldwide family of faith when our linkage points, institutions, are only forums of consultation and negotiation, with no power to make things happen or to make binding decisions. We must now grapple with the issue that in the end authority means the ability to order the life of the church across the world, even when some parts of the worldwide church mistakenly persist in ourselves alone courses of action. All families have to make difficult decisions that affect their common life. The healthiest way to do this, it seems to me, is to permit a vigorous internal debate about the common course of action to be adopted to address a dilemma. When the majority decision has been taken, then the family should close ranks and stick to that decision. There may be room and space for, as it were, an appeal debate, so that the point of view that did not prevail gets another chance to convince the others. But in the end, family members need to put passionate partisan positions aside and get in behind the collectively agreed position and the office bearers appointed to implement it. This is what we now need to do if we are to continue as an interdependent worldwide Anglican family. It will require us to give up a little of our liberty. But to what extent are we really free if we stymie and deadlock one another at so many levels as at present and then disintegrate into insignificant fragments through schism? Is there a mechanism by which this might happen? Yes, there is an historical precedent for church problem solving at the international level. In 1414, a general council of the church assembled in the city of Constance to deal with the greatest crisis the Western church had faced up till then, the Great Schism, by which two, and at times three, rival popes competed for leadership of the church for over three decades. Meeting for around 3.5 years, it resolved the crisis by deposing all the rival popes and electing a legitimate one instead. The council also set out to combat heresy and to reform the church at a number of levels. Meeting over such an extended period of time, it became something of a standing ecclesiastical parliament. It was an impressive achievement, and Christians all over Europe sat up and took notice. In the end, a revived papacy got on top of the conciliar movement and brought it to a halt. But people didn't forget what had happened, and it became one of the underground influences that prepared the ground for the English Church's later break with Rome. Furthermore, it's something of a model for what Anglicans believe might be the way ahead for rapprochement with the Roman Catholic Church, a kind of Vatican II in which the Bishop of Rome was a guiding rather than a dominating influence, in which the council, not the papacy, made the decisions that count. What we need to do is to call a pan-Anglican council of the worldwide Anglican Church with effective representation from every province for a no-holds-barred consultation about and resolution of all our outstanding issues, with the council having the power and authority to rule decisively at the end of its deliberations. Such a body, such a worldwide gathering might well commend itself to the worldwide Anglican family as a breakthrough point by which we come to accept authority as a gift from God and not a feared imposition of domination.